And I'll go ahead and get us started through the boilerplate part. So the highlight today is Tibor LD. So before that, we will do the IP note, call notes, scribe selection, introductions and reintroductions, announcements and reminders, and then we'll talk about a few action items. And lastly, the highlight will be Tibor LD, and then we will be having a preview of Jitsi afterwards, where we'll continue talking about Tibor LD. The idea is to sort of preview and stress test the new system, so it's optional. It's encouraged, though, if you can and want to join in additional conversation about Tibor LD. Okay, let's get started. So the IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. The link to join is pasted here in IRC. And you need to first ensure you have a W3 web account to do that. And that link is also in IRC. And lastly, the text of the W3C Community Contributor License Agreement is pasted here into IRC. Call notes, these minutes and an audio recording of everything said on this call are archived. We use IRC to cue speakers during the call as well to take the minutes. And the IRC channel was included in the invite that was sent out. All attendees should type present plus, as you can see other people doing the word present, symbol plus, no space in between, to get your name on the attendee list in the transcript. In IRC, to get yourself on the queue, type Q plus, that's the letter Q, symbol plus, no space, and you can add an optional reminder by saying two, plus to mention something, and that's the word. So if you're not on IRC, simply ask to be put on the queue and we'll add you. And please be brief so the rest of the queue can get a chance to chime in. You can always queue plus again. And note, this meeting is held by voice, not IRC. Off-topic IRC comments are subject to deletion from the record. We work hard to deletion from the record thread of conversation so everyone can participate and be heard. And please respect the group process by joining the queue when you have something to contribute. Okay, we need a scribe, and we're looking for volunteers. So one thing I want to highlight with our new system, we are hoping to have auto-scribing. So this may be one of the last nostalgic opportunities to scribe for the group. So if anyone wants to get in on that, feel free to volunteer to scribe. Otherwise, we'll go through the list of and call out people. Okay, let me start going through. The scribe list is available here. So I'll go through. Christopher Allen, are you available and able to scribe? Joe Andrew.
I can do it.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. I'm moving you to the last in the list. And yes, to Dan Burnett's comment about auto-scribing, I think, you know, we might keep with, we may do one of two things. We may continue designating a scribe, but then that person will be more in the position of correcting what's auto-scribed, or the chairs will simply do it. So I think we just kind of want to see what we're with first. Okay, and thank you, Joe, for scribing. Let me make sure you're attributed in IRC. Okay, introductions and reintroductions. Is there anyone new on the call that would like to introduce themselves? Okay, I think I see a few aliases that I don't recognize, so I'll call out a few, and first I'll say right now whose aliases I'll call out so that you can prepare, but then I'll go one by one so you don't have to all talk at once. So the first one is Ed Acholt. Next is Christina with a K. Third is Michael Weiss. So I'll go through in that order. Ed Acholt, are you here and able to introduce yourself?
Hi, I am. Ed Acholt. I'm with iRespond Global. We're a biometric service provider. I've been on the call before, but it's been quite a while. Know several people on the call. One of the things of interest is that we have a birth attestation project that will be generating identifiers, as well as QR codes for credentials. So that this topic is specifically interesting to me today.
Great. Thank you so much for joining. Next, we have Christina, that's with a K, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-A. Are you here and able to introduce yourself? Okay, I will call next on Michael Weiss. Yeah, that alias looks really familiar, but I figure I might as well call on you again. And sorry if you've introduced yourself recently. Okay, so now we can get into reintroductions. Anyone who is a regular attendee but has maybe, hasn't introduced themselves in a while, maybe going through a different job or project, and you want to share that with the group, this is a good time to volunteer. Add yourself to the queue or hopefully in a staggered manner speak up. Oh, Christopher. You are
good
up.
Morning. Thank you. Last time I talked with you, I was a co-chair, and now I'm not working hard to move from being a administrator talker to a doer. I'm with Blockchain Commons. We have a bunch of different things we're doing, but some of the stuff that directly affects this group is we're trying to create a basis under Wyoming law for what is digital identity that is able to express the self-sovereign identity principles. Blockchain Commons is in the process of trying to implement trustless, focused self-sovereign identity solutions. BTCR was, our baseline there, although the proposals from, 2-3 years ago haven't quite kept up with the latest of what's going on with Bitcoin. So part of what I'm puzzling out right now is, how to address that and potentially leverage some of the peer-to-peer and other newer techniques to do with Bitcoin, because obviously you don't want to have to pay a Bitcoin transaction every time you do certain types of things. So we can do that with some of the peer-to-peer DID stuff. So trying to put my head down to, coding and working with coders for the foreseeing year, Blockchain Commons, Christopher A. That's it.
Great. Thank you so much, Christopher, and thank you for your many years of service to CCG as chair and continued active involvement in leadership in the community. And next for reintroductions, we have John Callahan.
Thank you, Kim, and everyone else. Now, so this is John Callahan. I go by Jack, the CTO of Viridium. We have a new CEO, Ismet Jiri. Previously from Onfido, ForgeRock, and Transmit Security. And he's recommitted us to self-sovereign identity. So That's the only news here, and glad to attend the CCG. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, John. And let me see where we are. Okay. So, Dave, you're off the hook for reintroductions. You are next. We'll probably get to you next week. So we're moving ahead to announcements and reminders. Okay. We maintain the list of announcements and reminders at this location. And so obviously a lot of things are sort of light because of COVID, but the one event that is happening is Identiverse, which turned into a virtual event. And it looks like that's ending soon on the 6th of August. So it looks like there's still maybe some more events if you want to register there. I think that the registration is free. And then we have recurring meetings. So we have this weekly CCG call that you're on now every Tuesday. Our two other meetings, one is Verifiable Credentials for Education Task Force. I need to update that information. So we switch to every other Monday, and that's 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 Eastern in the U.S., and I think we have a few more time zones listed on the meeting page, which is at this location. And I run that group. Feel free to ping me, email me, or whatever, and I will add you to the invite so that you don't have to keep track of every other week yourself. Did resolution calls. Those are Mondays as well, weekly. 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. And there I have a meeting page I can add to IRC right now. Okay, and then lastly, secure data storage calls. Those are Thursday, and that's 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. Those are jointly run with the Decentralized Identity Foundation. So those are, let me paste in the information to sign up there. So yeah, that's on Thursdays. Join that for very focused discussion on data storage concerns. Okay, in just a minute, we may have a last-minute change of agenda. So I think Manu's introduction to CWRLD will be a just a non-technical introduction. So originally we had scheduled him for 30 minutes or the bulk of the call. But he only needs 15 minutes at the end, and then you can join afterwards for the Jitsi meeting preview and for more of a technical deep dive. Heather Vestant has a presentation on election integrity that's very timely and more broadly around misinformation, and Heather can give a more detailed discussion. Originally we had it on the meeting today, but removed it because we thought there wouldn't be enough time. But I think that we're going to add that after we go through the action items and work items. So thank you, Heather, for volunteering to do that. I think it'll be really interesting to tee up that discussion. Okay, progress on action items. So we maintain a list of action items that we're reviewing, and what the chairs do is we go through and we're just trying to make sure all of the action items and work items that the group has taken responsibility for are moving forward, finding out if there are any blockers, if there's anything we can do to help. Today we identified two issues that we wanted to try to move to resolution. So the first one is around the general area of JSON-LD context and supporting documentation. So that's tracked in two issues that I'm pasting to IRC. It's in the community GitHub repo issues number 97 and 88. So let me pull that up so we can talk to you a little bit more. So the TLDR, I think, so issue number 97 is talking about some concerns with hosting schemas for current JSON-LD signature documents and whether we want to take that on as a CCG work item. You'll notice that both for 97 and for 88, the conversation kind of snaked around a little bit. So we did do some resolutions in the process, but I think that the main lurking issue seems to be kind of uncertainty for developers as they get exposed to JSON-LD, the kind of work items they need to do in order to effectively use JSON-LD, like how to construct JSON-LD contexts, where to host them. Ori proposed a resolution that, or a way to allow us to move this forward, perhaps that would align incentives a little better. The proposal, though, to address it is to ensure that editors of any CCG specs that use JSON-LD would be listed as contacts at some TBD location, but someplace to make it discoverable so that when people have JSON-LD issues and come to this group, which is a very common idea, we're sort of the natural entry point for these concerns, that there's a list of contacts that can help people resolve those issues. So ideally, some things will improve around that. Like maybe we make it clear which repos are maintained for the purpose of hosting JSON-LD contexts. Maybe we improve our documentation. But essentially, it seems that without a focused working group, it's not really clear we can make progress right now. We don't want to force that working group to happen, but we do want to unblock the problem. And I think listing contacts to help people would be a good way to move that forward. Ori, is there anything else you want to add on this topic?
No, I think, you know, these issues have obviously been open for a really long time, and I'd love to close them. And I think the fastest way to close them is just to gather the CCG work items related to JSON-LD, gather the editors from those work items, and basically direct people to comment and question the editors if they have comments, questions, and concerns. That will force the editors to create standard operating procedures or documentation to answer questions that they keep getting asked. And obviously, everything else you said, I think is true. Like, we're a working group. We don't have a ton of process or time to make this much better than that. So I obviously propose all that stuff, and that's what I'm in favor of doing.
Yeah, I think that sounds really good. I think the other thing is that it's possible that some task force like VCEDU, we're working on schemas right now, so it may be in the context of a certain use case that we just need it to happen. And so I think I like the idea a lot of designating some editors. I think that this is something that the chairs can take on as, you know, figuring out where this information should go in terms of, you know, on the site and, you know, finding those work items, finding the editors. So I think the only issue would be if there's any strong objections as, you know, if you're a person who's a potential editor and you don't want to be contacted, that would be the only concern. Although at the same time, I think we would say improved documentation would help ensure that you're not having as many people contact you. So let me see if there's any discussion. Jonathan, you're up.
So can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So the only thing I would add is actually I would welcome external invited experts to review. So some of the vocabularies have snuck in from the W3ID. And my concern, I raised this in a different issue. I'm not sure if this is in this or just repo or different, about this creating new approaches to cryptography. And so I think we have to be careful to not to do that, because that's actually not in the charter. And I think it's okay to name something that already exists, but I worry that we've actually named something that doesn't exist in a way that actually is a slippery slope of opening the door for declaring new approaches to cryptography.
Okay, and actually, if you wouldn't mind linking to the comment, the issue comment that you added, that would help. I want to make sure that I understand that and we can address it. But I definitely like the idea of having external review. I think that we need to be doing this in tandem with the people actually working on the JSON-LD specification. Maybe there's ways we can help each other out in that. Okay, let me double check. There's no one else on the queue. Okay, with that, I think I'm going to leave that as the current proposal for those. So I think, like, these aren't work items, so there's no formal process around closing it. I think we can update the work items with that recommendation, or sorry, work items, the issues with that recommendation. If there's no problems with that, then the chairs can just move forward with closing them out with that recommended resolution. And I will be updating the issue 97 now, and so feel free to add any comments. Okay, now the next one is that security vocabulary needs more than one code owner. I think that what happened here is that there were a few work items that were grandfathered in from the digital verification community group, which we merged into the credentials community group. It turns out, though, when the repos are transferred over, we realized so it actually doesn't have a code owner file, but it only has one owner of the work item, and that's not in accordance with our process, which we recommend two owners from different organizations. And so we have a tracking issue at the following location that I'll put into IRC. Ori had proposed addition of himself and Tobias from Matter, which it seems like a good match. Manu, do you want to add anything to that?
No, just plus one that proposal.
Great. So let me make a note of that. I think that we'll also be able to close this issue as well after getting the accounting set up, which we can do. Okay, great. Let me see. 8-4, Tobias and Ori, and we'll close. Okay, great. That was all we had for these. Heather, if you're still game, or would you like to do your presentation now?
Yeah, Kim, I can do it for
great.
Sure. Okay, so I just threw this file up because I didn't think there was going to be time to do this today, and I didn't actually make any changes. I was going to just kind of maybe customize it to us a little bit more. And but we'll just go with it anyway. So please let me know if you guys are not able to access. It's a PDF. And to put a little context around this, because it might seem a little bit random for me to present this information in this group, but there's some reasons why that I think this is important. And really what you should be doing while I'm doing this presentation is just kind of like, sit back and take it all in. I have many thanks to Anil John. He asked my team to look into securing voter data about a year ago. And that kind of started out a little bit of my obsession on, what's the role of digital identity in elections. Separately, an area of interest for decades has been disinformation and misinformation. My approach comes to it from a very different approach where a lot of people are coming to it in modern day. Maskarovka, and I will type this in because, Joe, I'm sure you have no idea how to spell it, Maskirovka, is a Russian language term. I'll go into more detail about that in a bit. My interest and my experience with crafting narratives for people come from my art and culture jamming background when I was a member of the Cacophony Society in the late 90s. And I participated in and organized a lot of different culture jamming activities that were really, from an artistic perspective, used to challenge people's views of what reality is. And in some cases to, not necessarily lie, but really kind of challenge the thinking. And one of the pranks that we would do is we would do protesting, and it would just be a protest that we would want. It would be some silly thing. And the group would split into two groups, one that would be protesting for and one that would be protesting against. And so the point of the protest was to show the absurdity of whatever the topic at hand was. And so I just want to share some of that as that is my background and interest coming into this. And as I have become more, as I've researched this more over the last 3 or 4 years, I've started to learn about the military use of it. And there's a country that is very good at using it, and we are currently under attack, and that is Russia. And so that's Maskarovka. And so this presentation I'm going to talk about our election system. I'm going to introduce you guys to some of the more traditional, military understandings of Maskarovka and the umbrella term. And then I do actually talk about ways that we can solve these things. This is not only a technical problem, this is a social problem. And I do think there's opportunities for us in this community using identity technology to provide puzzle pieces and parts of solutions to combat this. And so that is why I think this presentation will be interesting to this community. So with that in mind, hopefully you guys open up the deck. And so I like to start out with a story. This is a really, really illustrative story. In 2016, the Illinois voter database was hacked, but the hack wasn't noticed for 3 weeks. During those 3 weeks, the hackers mostly laid low, but right before the Republican National Convention, the database admins noticed activity spikes and discovered the hack when they investigated those activity spikes. The hackers didn't change any of the data, but they did view 76,000 voter files, which included personal information like name, address, and date of birth. Who ended up being responsible for this? Well, Russian hackers. There's 4 volumes of Senate reports that talks about the various techniques and things. Some of the stuff is redacted of what actually occurred. And these hackers didn't just hack Illinois' database. They targeted all 50 states, and 21 states actually reported they were contacted by Russian addresses. Because of this hack, $14 million were allocated to improve cyber defenses, and today Illinois' database is more secure than ever. But that's not what was in the news when the story broke. We didn't know all this information, and headlines painted a story that showed we couldn't trust our elections, and maybe we couldn't trust our democracy. This story illustrates several ways our elections are vulnerable. I want to give like a quick overview of where identity is used in elections. This is a diagram from the Securing Voter Data Report. If you want to deep dive into that aspect, you can download that report. On the front end, you have to give your personal information to register to vote. And this is important because it makes sure you are registered to vote in the correct jurisdiction. In San Bernardino County, where I live, it's the largest county in the entire nation, there are many cities that have different things that you vote on election day. That's like water district or city council. And so you may have people coming to a polling location, and based on their addresses, they may actually get a different ballot. And actually, San Bernardino County is really bad. But, well, I'll go into that in a minute. On the back end, you have a database admin or someone like a human that is inputting that personal information into the voter registration database. That admin and other people who administer the database, they have account management. You need to have good database design and to be able to have good account management design. Poll workers, who are mostly volunteer, need to have access to this personal information. When you either come in to vote on the day, you get the voter roll and paper, or they can be electric poll books. And they need to be able to verify that you're supposed to be able to vote in this election at this location and which ballot to get. And then finally, voter files are your name and your personal information that you can buy or get access to from a local jurisdiction or Secretary of State that a campaign can use to run their election. So say anyone wanted to run for election, you need to be able to get the word out, contact, interact with potential with your voters. And to be able to get that, you can get these voter files. So those are all the different ways that identity is blended in elections. Now, attack surfaces are an entry point or a method that can be used to attack a system. There can be technical entry points like a poorly secured database, a phish account, or shared credentials, or a social vulnerability, which is like a free press that shows two sides, or sensational headlines or stories that don't show the full context. And so these two attack surfaces can be combined. From our report, we found a few technical attack surfaces. Technical attacks can go after control, go after access control by spear phishing individuals to gain access. They can try to get the data by exfiltrating data from a database, or when that information is being transferred from, say, like a motor vehicle registration card into the voter voter database. I would say that's probably a pretty low. The access control is a really big target. The data security is a concern. And then data manipulation. This is the most likely, but this vulnerability can turn into a social vulnerability when a hacker gets access to from an account that can change data, like in the example I showed, I told you about the 2016 voter Illinois database hack. The way you can combat that is by recording database changes and not just the end state. So you guys probably are already thinking about ways that our technology could potentially address some of the vulnerabilities of these technical attack surfaces. At least as I was writing this, that's what I was thinking. The point of the report and the point of the research was not to say use decentralized identity or use a specific identity to solve these problems. It was more about this is the context and these are the problems that we have. And then I'd like to leave it up to the ingenuity of us in the community to look at solving them. Now, these technical attacks can lead to social attacks. And in my opinion, these social attacks are more nefarious and difficult to combat. So the most concerning one is an attack on the confidence in our elections. And you don't have to go far to see that this is an attack that is constantly being lobbed on so many different levels. I want to also mention political profiling, and the goals for those can include triggering someone to go out and vote who wouldn't, dissuading someone not to go vote because out of apathy, and otherwise disenfranchisement. This really was an attack that was used in 2016, and it is somewhat being used a little bit now, but it's also lost a lot of its power because we're aware of it, and we're trying to make some changes within the platform. One other thing that's really important, this is like a really critical one that I don't think it was counterintuitive to me, but when I realized it, I thought, oh, it makes perfect sense, was election usability. We, as citizens, don't have a lot of daily experience in voting. And this includes being familiar with the voting process or machine or even ballots. When I was an election supervisor in San Bernardino County in March for the primary, we had over 30 different ballot types. And depending on your which party you were affiliated with and whether you wanted to do crossover voting and which jurisdiction you were in, you got one of these ballots. And now with some of the feedback I gave back to my county to say, we need to make these ballots more user-friendly, not just to the poll workers, but to the people using it. And voters are often able to familiarize themselves with voting machines or ballots prior to voting. And this is actually one reason why vote by mail is so good, because it allows someone to take as much time as they need, become really familiar with the issues, and also familiar with the actual ballot and successfully use the ballot. So these two attacks support each other. And we can see in the Illinois example that the technical attack was to gain access control to the database. And the social attack was the subsequent media coverage, which resulted in the "Can we trust our elections?" question. And the solution was to increase security funding. But that doesn't necessarily address the social attack. That doesn't necessarily increase confidence in the election. And there's other fears and misinformation. There is a false narrative of non-citizens or illegals voting, which has led to voter purges of legitimate voters. And it's important to note that voter rolls change all the time due to legitimate reasons like deaths, name changes, and moving. And we need to increase the usability in being able to make those changes and be confident that those changes are valid and legit. Georgia is a great example of sabotage through disorganization, and where they limited working voting machines, which caused people to wait for hours to vote. It's also an example of a conflict of interest where the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, was responsible for overseeing Georgia's election while running as a candidate in it. One of the things that I've been noticing in the current state of InfoWar and what's happening in the world today is there is a lot of sabotage going on. And earlier this year, I wrote a book on spies and espionage, which included both the modern and future of it, but then it also required me to do a lot of history of espionage. And during World War II, both the U.S. and Britain had like the SOC and OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and I don't remember SOC. Both of those entities were created to sabotage the Nazis in Europe. And as I was researching that, I thought, man, sabotage, that just doesn't happen anymore. But as I learned more about what sabotage was, I realized and was able to recognize some of the activities that were happening to sabotage our election system and to decrease efficiency and to have things take more time and just be like, oh, it's broken, so, you know, sorry, it's going to take 2 hours for you to vote because we only have one voting machine, like what happened in Georgia. Finally, one of the other fears is family coercion. And this isn't so much in the U.S., but in U.K. and other countries that have very traditional family structures. Parents may insist that their children vote a certain way. Or even I saw here, partners would help complete mail-in ballots. And when I was election supervisor, you could come in and drop your mail-in ballots. And I did see, you know, people come in and bring in, like, the ballots of their partners and stuff. And, you know, that's great to be able to do that, you know, as a way to make sure that someone who might not be able to get out of the house to actually vote, but also, there could be coercion happening as well. So these are ways that our election system is vulnerable, which makes it a tempting target. And as technologists, we think about technology vulnerabilities and how to solve them, but the primary attack here isn't technical, it's an information attack using a social vector. And so let's go to Moscow. Oh, wow, I just realized I'm running out of time. All right, well, we'll just jet through Maskarovka. Unfortunately, this is kind of like the meat of the deck. So Maskarovka is a Russian term to describe an umbrella set of Russian information operations, and it means to camouflage the truth. And those are some examples. The goal, basically, is of these information operations is to shape your view of reality to one where you make decisions that benefit your adversary. It's primarily been viewed from a military perspective and documented in use from Russia since the 1990s. And it's important to point out that, while I'm talking about Maskarovka in the context of Russia, they're not the only ones that do this. China does it, of course, and of course we do in the U.S. as well. One thing that's important to note in 2020 is that we have unlocked what I like to call as entrepreneur mode, which means that there's no top-down strategy from the Kremlin on what kinds of disinformation operations or false narratives should be put out there, but rather there's many operations and narratives that don't necessarily that start with government involvement or even get government involvement. It's kind of like the startup competition of information operations looking for VC funding. And this really explains the contradictory techniques and narratives. As I said, the goal is to freeze your decision-making process. Let me just skip ahead to information operations in 8 steps. This is from Bruce Schneier. Like many security professionals, I love Bruce. So these are kind of like the 8 characteristics of what's in an information operation. So you want to figure out where there's a divide. You want to put those cracks, make those cracks even more with distortions. Really important is 3 is wrap narratives around a kernel of truth. Conspiracy theories and information operations are always anchored in some truths with evidence, and this makes it really hard to combat them. And then you build audiences, and this can be funding people. You conceal your hand. You say that you're not involved, even if it's obvious. You use useful idiots who are going to promote your agenda, and you deny that you're involved. And this is not a short-term agenda. When nation states use these methods, it's to win hearts and minds or destroy a nation that they lost the Cold War to. And it's about changed belief, reflective actions, and a shifting power. I'm going to skip through like some of the examples I have, like the false narratives, bot networks, deep fakes, manipulated media, etc., and just kind of skip forward to what can we do. Probably a lot of you guys are already interested, or you know about some of these specific examples. So we need to have technical and social solutions that work together. From a technical side, we need to have solutions on the platforms. So WhatsApp India did a fact check, and if that fact check failed, did not allow to share. You need to be able to label disinformation or misinformation and make it easy to report and remove bots. We have this idea coming up with video provenance, so verify the source and whether it's been tampered or how it's been tampered. And then detecting deep fakes through the same algorithms that are used to create them. From social suggestions, we need to do or have an increase of fact-checking. I like this example called SIFT. It is a method to be able to triangulate what's true. You need to realize that everything is biased. And if you know everything is biased, you can look at you can say, okay, this is biased in this way, and this is biased in this way, and this is biased in this way, and you can actually kind of triangulate aspects of the truth and understand the story. And one thing that's really important that I don't really see talked about a lot is an increase in emotional resilience. So if you are emotionally triggered, that's by design, and you need to pause before you do something. Identity people think we can improve this area. So we need to build usable technology, and most importantly, understand that local government isn't the same as private sector. And one thing that's really important is that really the democracies are at a disadvantage. Authoritarian regimes don't have to follow pesky data transparency rules. And most importantly, understand that you are a target, both yourself, your technology, and your company. And so you can download some data. I've written about this, and hopefully we can use some of our technologies to potentially combat this stuff longer term. And I'll turn it back over to you, Kim. Manu, sorry, we just went over a little bit.
Thank you, Heather. And Manu, I'll turn over to you.
Sure thing. Thanks. Yes, and that was super fascinating. Plus one for having an extended session on it and understanding how we can apply some of the lessons learned to the stuff that we're working on. All right, CBOR LD. So this is going to be a fairly high-level non-technical intro. I'm going to speed through it. Here's the presentation deck. And then if you can't get to that presentation deck, there is a PDF file here that I will also drop into IRC. I'm going to start out at the beginning. So this is an introduction to a new data format that we're playing around with that is meant to apply to verifiable credentials and decentralized identifier documents. So a lot of the work that we're doing here, we're hoping that it kind of helps. For those that haven't heard of it, the technology CBOR stands for the Concise Binary Object Representation. So it's basically a way of expressing data in a compact form. So I'm starting on slide one, jumping to slide two. So just to identify the problem really quickly, the problem is that for some use cases, verifiable credentials and DID documents are too big. The size of the document itself makes it impossible to achieve some use cases. Moving on to slide three, one of these use cases is like if you just want to present a verifiable credential using your mobile device, using a QR code. So they're like offline use cases that suffer from the size of the verifiable credentials and decentralized identifier documents that we have today. On to slide four. To give you an example of this problem, if we just take a typical verifiable credential, like an education credential or you know any kind of credential that we have today, we're dealing with about 1,200 bytes of information. And the image on the left is what 1,200 bytes of information looks like in a QR code. That thing is really hard to scan. From a mobile phone. There's too much data there. Really, what we want to get to is something that looks like the image on the right, 400 bytes. So the thing that you'll notice here is the size of the dots are bigger on the image on the right versus the image on the left, which basically means there's less data that's transmitted on the image of the right. If we can get our data sizes down to below 400 bytes, all of a sudden, all kinds of really important offline use cases become possible for decentralized identifiers and verifiable credentials. So skipping on to slide five, the goal here is to figure out a way to compress the documents that we're using. We're going to focus on JSON-LD compression primarily because a lot of people are using that for verifiable credentials, and a decent chunk of the community is using that for DID documents. There's some tricks that we can use in JSON-LD to get us down to a reasonable size. Jumping on to slide six, I'm going to skip to the end, right? So the problem was, you know, verifiable credential documents are too big. If we apply CBOR LD, do we solve the problem? And what this graph is meant to show on slide six is that we get some pretty amazing compression if we use CBOR LD. So we started at 1,200 bytes We needed to get below 400 bytes to meet our offline use cases, and CBOR LD gives us something on the order of 325 bytes in size. What that means is that all of a sudden, all kinds of use cases where you don't have a cell network, or the cell network is down, or you want to be very secretive in the way that you're engaging with someone else, not using a mobile network, these are all possible if we use CBOR LD. Moving on to slide 7. So effectively, what we're trying to show here with CBOR LD is that we can go from very large data sizes and we can get them to around 1/5 of their original size. So the size of the QR code that we need, on slide 7, the image is, you know, fairly large with 1,200 bytes, and it becomes much smaller with 325 bytes. On slide 8, the thing that we're trying to point out here is that this also matters when you have systems at scale. Like if we have these huge digital wallet systems that we're all imagining are going to exist in a couple of years, these huge decentralized identifier documents on, you know, anchored on public blockchains, storage size matters a lot. So the graphs on slide 8 basically show you how much storage you would need for 1 billion verifiable credentials. So if you wanted to store a billion verifiable credentials today, you would need upwards of like 800 terabytes worth of information, 800 terabytes worth of storage, almost a petabyte worth of storage. That's a lot of storage. But if you were to just if the only thing you did was encode in CBOR LD, you would need a third of that, right? So around a little more than 250 terabytes of information. So all that to say, the reason that we're talking about CBOR LD is that there's a use case, there are a set of use cases where we need small sizes for verifiable credentials and decentralized identifier documents, and CBOR LD gets us there. Now, at a very high level, how does this work? Slide 10. Basically, to understand how CBOR LD works, you need to understand a tiny bit about how compression works. So compression uses something called a compression dictionary. The dictionary tells you how to map really big, long strings, like long sets of words, to short sets of words. So if we look at slide 10, the thing on the left is our original document. It says very long value A, and then another big value B, and then another big value B, and very long value A. That's many, many tens of bytes in size. But we can notice that there's information in there that's repeating. And if we build a compression dictionary, we'll find that there are really only two types of information we need to express. And we can say when we're expressing the first thing, very long value A, we're going to use a 1 to represent that. And then when we express another big value B, we're going to use the number 2 to express that. That's our compression dictionary. And if we use that compression dictionary, we can take this message that's really big on the left-hand side and compress it down into just 4 numbers, right? So that's the key to a good compression format, is you need to be able to create this compression dictionary in a way that gives you really optimal compression. So moving on to slide 11, that's fundamentally what CBOR LD does. We have this thing in JSON LD called a context, and the context is effectively a compression dictionary of some kind. We've all agreed to a compression dictionary unknowingly, but we did it when we created the verifiable credentials JSON LD context, right? The mere fact that that thing exists means that we can use it as a compression dictionary, and because we can use it as a compression dictionary, then all of a sudden we can very efficiently compress words like verifiable credential and issuance date and issuer. And so that's effectively what CBOR LD does. It uses the JSON LD context to build a compression dictionary, and we can get some pretty amazing compression sizes from that. If we go down to slide 12, this is just looking at the one line in a JSON LD document, the context line. It's 53 bytes in size. If we use a CBOR LD compression dictionary, we can get it down to 2 bytes in size. massive, massive compression there. And in fact, this compression is better than state-of-the-art binary compression today. Moving on to slide 13, the vision for CBOR LD is really to do byte-level semantic processing on data. So once we do this compression, normally you have to decompress things to work with it. Like if you get a zip file, you have to decompress it to work with the data in the zip file. CBOR LD is fundamentally different. You can compress things and then operate on the compressed data. You don't have to re-inflate the data. So we can do byte-level semantic processing. We can go to CBOR LD and stay there. We can do semantic processing over fixed data structures, which means that we can build hardware to actually process verifiable credentials at scale, which means smaller data, which means faster calculations, which fundamentally means that we can get artificial intelligence to process these credentials on our behalf far more efficiently than we could with a bigger data format. Okay, so that's it. That's the end of the presentation. We're going to switch over to a way more technical kind of discussion on this during after hours, but there are two links at the end of this presentation that are important. This isn't a theoretical exercise. There is an implementation for CBOR LD today, and there is a very loose specification for CBOR LD. So with that, we'll go ahead and stop and switch over to after hours. I'll hand it back over to the chairs. Chairs, I do have two requests for people when they switch over, so let me know when you want me to make those requests. Back over to you, chairs.
Great. Thank you, Manu. And actually, now, okay, so we do have someone on the queue. I'll call on Jonathan, and then, yes, please follow up with, we're nearly at time. So, yeah.
So, it, do you have, so where is this work being incubated?
So in Digital Bazaar right now, and we hope to make it a work item at the W3C in a community group, but probably the JSON LD community group.
But this and is that going to be presented there as well?
Yeah, it maybe. I don't know yet. We're still trying to schedule something. But yes, probably, Jonathan.
Manu, if you could go ahead and give the information for after hours.
Sure. Okay, so we're going to switch over to a new conferencing system. It's got high-definition audio and video. It's kind of like Zoom, but it also connects to IRC. So we're going to give you a URL. Please go to that URL, and you'll be there kind of in a waiting room. We're going to disconnect everyone from this bridge. Please do not call back into the bridge. It will confuse the bots. The order of operations is we're going to give you a URL. Go ahead and go to the URL. We're going to kick everyone off of the bridge that we're all on right now, and then we're going to start up the next meeting. During the meeting, please don't dial into this bridge that we're on right now. Again, it will confuse the bots. This may end in disaster, so we're going to try for a while. We'll use IRC as a troubleshooting area if things don't go according to plan. If it becomes clear that the system's just not going to work, we'll notify everyone in IRC. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and drop the link into IRC chairs, and then we'll probably need to do this a couple of times. But go ahead, everyone, go ahead and disconnect. Once everything's settled, we'll give everyone the join link.